Our text this morning is from Luke chapter 19 and reading verses 11 through 27. Luke 19, verses 11 through 27. Here's what Luke writes. As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable because he was near to Jerusalem and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank? And at my coming, I might have collected it with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has the 10 minas. And they said to him, Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. When the Romans invaded Palestine in the year 63 BC, the family of Herod strongly supported the Roman invasion. That family support for Roman authority and control continued in the years to come, with the upshot that Herod the Great, as he came to be called, was nominated by the Roman Senate to be king of Judea. Well, the emperor confirmed the Senate's nomination, and Herod, who had gone to Rome, returned to Palestine and indeed to rule as king. He ruled for many years. By the way, this is the Herod to whom the wise men came in Matthew chapter 2. Remember, we've seen the star in the east. We've come to, where is this one who's born king of the Jews? They asked Herod. Well, Herod died in the year 4 BC. And everyone assumed that upon his death, his son, Herod Archelaus, would now assume the throne. Well, Archelaus, Herod's son, indeed did seize the throne immediately, but there was only one man in the entire world who had the power and the authority to make him king, and that was the emperor in Rome who happened to be Caesar Augustus. And so Archelaus made a trip to that distant country, to Rome, so that he might receive the kingship from Caesar Augustus. Well, when he arrived in Rome, he discovered that there were a whole lot of people who were saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. There were some in his own family. They wanted the throne instead. And so they appealed to Caesar Augustus, expressed their reasons why Herod Archelaus should not be king. There was a delegation of 50 Jews who traveled from Jerusalem to that distant country. And they appeal to Caesar that he not be made king, because one of the things he had done is there had been Passover celebration in Jerusalem, and there had been a disturbance in the temple courts, and Archelaus had sent in his troops and slaughtered 3,000 Jewish worshipers there in the courts. We do not want this man to rule over us, the delegation of 50 said. And not only that, but there was a public gathering of 8,000 Jews who were citizens of Rome who appealed to Caesar and said, "We do not want this man to ever reign over us." Well, the upshot of it all was that Caesar Augustus put in place a compromise, which much to his dismay didn't please anybody. He approved Archelaus as ruler over Judea, but he would not grant him the title of king. Well, Archelaus returned to Judea, but things didn't go well, and after several years, Rome removed him from power altogether. This was a news story everybody knew. It had been on TV, so to speak. It had been in the papers. It's a news story from 30 years ago, and Jesus takes this very familiar news story and uses it as the backdrop for this parable that he tells, a parable about a nobleman who went to a distant country to receive a kingship, but whose subjects didn't want him to rule over them. Now, to understand this parable, I want you to see the context, and Luke lays it out for us beautifully in verse 11. You notice how our text begins. It says, "As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable." What things? Well, you don't have to go back but a few verses in the text. It's what Jesus said to Zacchaeus. That's what they had heard. Remember, Zacchaeus is converted. And when Jesus and Zacchaeus come out of the house, Zacchaeus says, "Half of my goods I give to the poor. If I have defrauded anybody, I pay back fourfold." And Jesus said to him, verse 9, "Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable. What had they heard him say? Deliverance is here. Salvation has come. They didn't understand it in the idea of personal conversion, which is what Jesus was talking about. They heard Jesus say, "The day of deliverance is at hand." And the crowd, surely if it's arrived for Zacchaeus, boy, it's arrived for all of us. We're near Jerusalem. The Passover celebration is just in a handful of days. The great day of the Lord is here. The kingdom in all of its glory is dawning, they thought to themselves. That day of freedom and joy and universal peace is at hand. Now is the time when Messiah is going to reign over the whole earth. Today deliverance has come. You bet it has. Today salvation has come. Jesus just said it. Hearing these things, Jesus tells the parable. And notice how Luke makes clear in the rest of verse 11 that that was indeed their attitude and their mindset. Again, verse 11, "As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable because, number one, he was near to Jerusalem, and because, number two, they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately, he said, therefore." All right, there's the context, there's the setting of the parable. Now, you notice, as they heard these things, who's the ambiguous they in verse 11? Well, it's the crowd, isn't it? All right, it's the crowd. The next question to ask is, so who comprised the crowd? Well, there were the 12 apostles. There were other disciples, followers of Jesus. There were the unconvinced, there were the curious. There certainly were enemies, there were opponents of Jesus in the crowd. So it's a mixed group of believers and unbelievers that are part of the crowd. And Jesus, in a brilliant way, addresses both audiences in the same parable. Both those who are his enemies and want to destroy him, and those who are his followers, he addresses them both in one story. And to both his followers and to those who are his enemies, you notice, Jesus makes it clear he's not traveling to Jerusalem to claim a throne marked by earthly glory and splendor. Luke tells us that in verse 11. Instead, what he's going to be doing, yes, he's going to be traveling to Jerusalem, but from there he's going to be going to a distant country. Well, what's the distant country? It's heaven. And what's the road that's going to get him there? Well, it's what's on the horizon, the cross. It's the resurrection. It's the ascension. And so he is going to a distant country to receive a kingship, and he's going to come back. And when he does, this one of noble birth is going to come with kingly power and great authority, authorized to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And Jesus says in this story, to those in the crowd who reject his lordship, to those in the crowd who are his enemies, Jesus gives a warning, doesn't he, in this text. On that great day when he returns from the distant country, having received the kingship, those who did not want him to reign over them will experience judgment and death when the king returns. But to those in the crowd who embrace his lordship, to those in the crowd who say, I'm a servant, I'm a follower of this one, Jesus calls those folks to faithfulness and to accountability. In the interim between when I go to the distant country and when I come back having received the kingship, there is the call to you as my followers to accountability and to faithfulness. So with that framework in place, let's just very briefly work our way through this story Jesus tells. You notice in verse 12 the main character of the story. It is a man of noble birth. Ah, you never would have guessed Jesus of Nazareth was of noble birth, would you, born in a manger? Having no property, no money? Ah, but this one, to all appearances to the contrary, one of noble birth, well-born, son of David, entitled to the kingdom. And this person, none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, he travels to that distant country, and he comes back having received a name that is above every name. He comes back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, before whom every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that he is indeed Lord to the glory of God the Father. Verse 13, but before he leaves on that journey to that distant country, he entrusts each of his 10 servants with exactly the same amount of money. You notice that. To each servant, he has 10 servants, 10 minas, one mina handed out to each of the 10 servants. Mina was about average salary for 3 months for a common worker. You can do a little math and see what that might be. By the way, don't confuse this parable with the one Jesus tells just shortly after. It's in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. The two stories are very similar. If you read Matthew 25, they're very, very similar. The only difference being in the Matthew 25 parable, the servants receive different amounts of money. In this parable, every servant receives exactly the same. And you notice the number 10. There are 10 servants, there are 10 minas. 10 in the Bible is the number of completion. I think many of you understand that that's so. 10, for example, closes out all the fundamental numbers and encompasses them all. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The basic set of numbers. 10 is indeed the number of completeness. You have the 10 commandments. What is our duty to God? What is our duty to neighbor? It's summarized completely and fully in 10 statements. You remember the parable in Matthew 25 about the 10 virgins. 5 are wise, 5 are foolish, but there are 10 of them representing the visible church. Some wise, some foolish. And so here you again, you have that number 10. 10 in the story symbolizes everybody who identifies with the Christian church. You have the enemies, the opponents, those that don't want him to reign over them. But then you have those who say, I am part of the kingdom. I am a servant of this one. So to each servant, the coming king gives a mina to each. And what is the mina? Because in Matthew 25, what's given is different amounts. God gives different gifts, different abilities to different people. Matthew 25 story makes that clear. So this isn't differing gifts that we have. This isn't different abilities that we have. Because every believer, everyone who says, I'm a servant of the Lord, receives exactly the same. So what is the mina? You can think about it as the Word of God. You can think about it as the gospel, which when you invest the gospel, it's the power of God unto salvation for all who will believe. It's the word of the kingdom. It's the gospel. It's the truth of heaven that has been entrusted equally to each one of us as believers. And so notice that then in the story. So the master says to these 10 servants, I want you, each of you, to take the mina I have given to you and to engage in business with it. Make use of it. Invest it until that day that I return. And so verse 14. So the nobleman travels to this distant country to receive the kingdom. But in the meantime, the citizens at large, a great number of them, do all that they can to prevent him from ever returning as king. In the immediate context, who are those citizens who say we do not want him to rule over us? In the immediate context, it's his own people, of course. He came to his own, John 1, and his own did not receive him. We do not want this man to rule over us. You have a foreshadowing of the crucifixion when the Jewish leadership and the Romans said, we're going to do away for him, with this one who claims to be the king of the Jews. We're doing away with him once and for all, nailing him to a cross. We do not want this man to rule over us. But in the context of the whole New Testament, it broadens out beyond that to include the world at large. People of whatever era and time and country and race who say, we do not want this Jesus to rule over us. And they oppose him. Why? You notice, what does the text say? Verse 14, but his citizens hated him. There's no reason given, is there? Remember the words of Jesus in the upper room in John 15 and verse 25? He says, they hated me without a cause. And so it is here in this story. So they hated him for no legitimate reason whatsoever. They send a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to rule over us. How does that work? How does the world send a delegation to heaven, to that distant country, saying, we don't want this Jesus ever to come back and rule over us? It happens through every act of hostility to the Christian church. It happens when believers are persecuted, when they are mocked, when they are marginalized, when believers from Stephen onward for 2,000 years have been martyred. Every time there is a martyr, every time there is a law passed, every time there is persecution, to whatever degree, it is sending an embassy to heaven saying, we don't want this man to rule over us. So the world sends notification. It has for 2,000 years. We want nothing to do with Jesus and this kingship. But you notice, thank God, verse 15, all their efforts are to no avail. This one of noble birth returns with the kingdom. And what happens when he returns? Well, what about his enemies? You have to go to the very end of the parable to see what happens to those who said, we don't want him to rule over us. So jump all the way down to verse 27. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. In ancient cultures, a king would put his enemies to death literally in his presence. He'd watch it be done. And the point of what Jesus says here is when he returns, those who oppose his rule and reign will be judged, will be cast eternally into the lake of fire. So much for the enemies. Well, what about the servants? The bulk of the parable is about those who claim to be the king's servants. So let's pick up verse 15. So the king is returned, and he calls his servants. He had said to them, I want to know what you've gained by doing business. So he calls them in one by one. Jesus in the story just highlights three representative servants. And you notice in verse 16, the first servant, notice carefully what he says. He says, "Lord, your mina has made 10 more." Notice what he doesn't say. "Lord, my skill, you wouldn't believe it. I was so good with money. I was so good with what you entrusted to me. My cleverness, my investment strategy, all of it paid off in a big time way. I mean, look at what I was able to accomplish." He doesn't say that, does he? He says, "Your mina." That the power and the multiplication was in what was entrusted to him, not in the servant. That's the power of the gospel. The gospel changes hearts, changes lives, grows, expands. The church, the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. Your mina is what accomplished the great things, not me and my wisdom and my skill and my whatever. So notice carefully what the servant says. The credit goes to the Lord. It is your mina. It is your word. It is your truth. It is your gospel. It is your spirit that you entrusted to me. That's what did the great things. Psalm 115 in verse 1, "Not to us, O Lord, but to your name be the glory." Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 10, "Not I, but the grace of God." And so this first servant reports that the 10 minas, or the mina that had been entrusted to him, ended up being multiplied to 10. And again, don't miss that 10 is the number of completion. And so this servant reports the fullest gain possible. That's the point of what Jesus is making. And what is the response? Verse 17, "Well done." Well done. As a believer, don't you long to hear that one day? That what has been entrusted to you when you stand and give an account for the mina that was placed in your care, to hear the King, Jesus himself, say, "Well done." And notice there is reward, and the reward is way out of proportion. This is what grace is, by the way. Because the servant says, "It wasn't me, it was all you, Lord Jesus. It was your mina. It was the power of your gospel, the power of your word." But what does the King do? Just in lavish, overwhelming, prodigal kind of generosity, he says to this servant, "Be ruler over 10 cities." Again, don't miss the number 10. Symbolic of the highest possible reward. That's what grace does. One day when we receive, that's why we're going to cast our crowns before the throne when we get them, because we know we didn't earn them, we didn't deserve them. It's all of grace, and we'll cast them before the throne in glory. But grace is an amazing thing. The reward is an amazing thing. The second servant, Jesus just abbreviates it, but the point is the same. The servant says, "Your mina has multiplied to 5. This second servant is not any less faithful than the first one. Maybe he didn't have the same opportunities that the first one has. That may be so. Maybe lived a life of lowliness in very humble circumstances. That might be the case. But he is equally commended. He is equally rewarded in an astounding way. Be ruler over 5 cities. How amazing that is. And by the way, when you think about rewards in heaven, rewards for faithful servants, I want you to understand what Jesus is saying is, the reward is not greater privileges. It is greater responsibilities. So in other words, heaven is not going to be kicking back and relaxing and lounging around in my mansion. If that's your picture of heaven, it couldn't be more wrong. What is heaven like? It will be a place marked by expanding and increasing service for all of eternity to magnify and glorify the King. That's what heaven will be. Now, verse 20, we come to the third servant, and it's really significant that of the 17 verses in the text, 7 verses deal with servant number 3. So I want to spend a little more time then with the third servant. You notice what this servant says in verse 20. He says kind of the same thing, at least to start with. He addresses the king as Lord, like the other servants do. He says, "You're mine," like the other servants do. But then you notice what a difference. "Here's your money back. I never did a thing with it," he says to the king. And rather than owning up to his failure to invest his master's resources, you notice what he does. He blames the master for his lack of success. What he says is, just notice, kind of paraphrase what he says here. "If I had made money with the mina, you being the kind of person you are, you would have taken it away from me. And if I had lost money off of the mina, then you would have punished me. So what I did was I just played it safe the whole time you were gone." And you notice down in verse 21, "I was afraid of you because you were a severe man." So it's not my fault for being afraid. It's your fault for being the kind of person you are and frightening me. So the problem is yours, not mine. Don't blame me for doing nothing with the mina. Well, you notice in this whole passage, the master is actually marked by extravagant generosity. Witness the rewards that he just lavishly pours out. But you notice, for the sake of argument, look at verses 22 and 23. The master adopts the servant's premise for the sake of argument. So he said, "So let's say you really were afraid. You know, I'm a tough guy. I'm a severe man. All that sort of thing. So if that's really true, if that's what you really believed, then what you should have done is given the mina to somebody who would know what to do with it." And Jesus says here, "Why didn't you at least put it in the bank? Why didn't you at least buy a certificate of deposit with it? If you'd done something even as simple as that, there would have been at least some interest that would have accrued. There would have been at least a small profit. But you didn't do that." No. And so he calls him, verse 22, he says, "No, you are a wicked servant." And the king says to those standing around, you notice verse 24, "Take the mina from him," from the guy who wrapped it up and put it in his dresser drawer and kept it all nice in his handkerchief. "Take that mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10. And you notice everybody standing around, verse 25, in essence say, "Really? I mean, he already has 10. What, we're adding another one?" But you think of it, of all the servants, which one will make best use of that mina? Well, the one who comes to the master, comes to the king, having made 10 in return. All right, so that's the story. But I want us to think about this third servant for just several minutes. And I want you to hear the word of Jesus in this text, because the bulk of the passage deals with servant number 3. And the point of all of this is that non-participation in the kingdom is not an incidental matter with Jesus. The point of this parable is that silence and inactivity are inexcusable. And if a person refuses to obey, if a person does nothing with what was entrusted to him or her, that servant puts him in the place of being liable to the same judgment meted out to the defiant, rebellious subjects who said, "We do not want this man to rule over us." So the question I was thinking about this week is, so how many are there in the church who are like servant number 3? The church at large? And let's bring it down to our own congregation at Grace. Are there those who say that they're in some way connected to the church, some way associated with the church, who would say, "I'm not opposed to Jesus"? Why, no. I'm not opposed to the church. I mean, I may never come or anything, but I'm not opposed to Jesus. I'm not opposed to the church. I want the church to be around when I need it. If I decide ever to come to a service, I want the doors to be open. If I have a son or daughter getting married, I want to have a church wedding. They'd want to have a church wedding. So, you know, we have a connection with the church for that reason. When grandma dies, we don't want to just be over at Nero's funeral home. We want to be able to have the funeral here in a church sanctuary. That's so much better, of course. I want to have a church. I want a place where I can send my kids to Sunday school or send them to Awana. So what I'm going to do is take the mina, take my religion, and just wrap it up in a handkerchief, and I'm going to put it carefully in the dresser drawer so I know where it is so that I don't lose it. I'm just going to preserve it. In the meantime, I'm going to focus on other things. I've got a job that takes a lot of my time. I'm interested in all kinds of sports activities. I'm busy with all kinds of school things. I have responsibilities. I have a whole wide range of interests. I'm not about to sacrifice my time, my energy, my life, my money, whatever it is. I'm not about to sacrifice anything for the good of the kingdom to see to it that mina that's been entrusted to me multiplies. I don't really have time for that, but I'll keep it safe. Nothing's going to happen to it. Be sure of that. And I'll return it to you at the end. Are there people like that in the church? Yes. What about our congregation? You need to answer that question. There's a lot of reasons why a servant might end up being a wicked servant, a faithless servant. I was challenged by something that I read, Kenneth Bailey. I've enjoyed reading him over the years. He died back in 2003. In his day, he was considered to be the premier authority on what life was like in Bible days, what culture was like, what practices were like, just a brilliant scholar considered to be the authority. And I want you to hear his take on this parable. It gave me a great deal to think about. As he writes about this, he points out that all 10 servants knew about the delegation that was going to the distant country saying, we don't want this man to rule over us. And those delegations that kept going were large in number, far more than the little handful of servants who were entrusted with the mina. And so the third servant thinks to himself, you know what? I'm not sure how all this is going to turn out. I'm not sure how this journey is going to turn out. The political situation is uncertain. Most of the citizens say we don't want this man to rule over us. So the wise thing to do is just carefully put the mina away and see how things shake out. And see in the end who wins the right to rule. And he writes, so when you look at the story from that framework, then what the nobleman is doing in this story with each of his servants, he is saying to them in essence, are you willing to stand openly for me in a culture, in a day where most people say we don't want this man to rule over us? Are you willing to stand as my loyal servant in a world where many ridicule and oppose and persecute anyone who says I'm a servant of that coming king? He says that may be the thinking of that third servant. It's an interesting take on this story. Because once this one returns with kingly power, it'll be easy to declare yourself on that. Yep, I was a servant. See, I got the mina here in the drawer. Here it is. Yep, I was one of yours. And as he wraps all of that up, he relates an interesting story from the country of Latvia that resonated very much with me. Communism collapsed in the country of Latvia in 1991. The Soviet domination, Soviet troops were out of Latvia in 1991, which meant now, for the first time in many, many years, the Christian faith could now be openly embraced. It could now be openly proclaimed. There could be schools, Christian schools, those sorts of things. 3 years after the fall of communism in 1991, I had the privilege in the spring of 1994 to go to Latvia. And I was invited to go there to train lay leaders in the Lutheran Church, which is one of the main denominations in Latvia. Because during Soviet domination, no seminaries were open, very few pastors, and so the church is sort of leaderless. And so the idea was to bring in lay leaders from all the Lutheran congregations across the country, bring them to the capital city, which they did. They came in by train. They came in by every kind of conveyance you can think of. And I was invited, along with several others, to train all these Lutheran lay leaders from all the Lutheran congregations in Latvia in some short courses, get them equipped, prepared to go back to their churches and be effective leaders until such time that the Lord would provide a pastor for them. It was one of the highlights of my life, is having that opportunity. Well, what resonated with me is Kenneth Bailey tells about being in Latvia, in Riga, about 3 years after I was there, in the doing the same thing with the Lutheran Church. By that time, there was an academy opened in Riga. It was called the Luther Academy. And he was there also to teach some short courses. And he tells how he had the opportunity to watch the interviewing process for new students who were applying for the Luther Academy. They wanted to be trained as pastors in the Lutheran Church. And so Kenneth Bailey said, I asked the interviewing committee, what kind of questions are you asking these applicants? Because of course, the whole conversation was in the Latvian language. He was just observing. And they said to him, the most important question that we ask these applicants is this: when were you baptized? And Kenneth Bailey said, I asked them, why is the date of baptism so important? Here's what he writes. If they were baptized during the period of Soviet rule, they risked their lives and compromised their futures by being baptized. But if they were baptized after liberation from the Soviets, we have many further questions to ask them about why they want to become pastors. The bottom line of this parable challenges us to examine. We would all say, I'm a servant. What kind of servant are you? Is that posture of servanthood genuine, or is it merely external and in the end will mean nothing? That's what this parable challenges us with. And if it is real for you, and I know for many of you it is wonderfully real, do you embrace the honor that you as a servant, that's who you and I are, that we should be entrusted with the wealth of heaven? Does that amaze you? That the King has entrusted you with something of value, the awesomeness of you being a trustee of the kingdom, and just to marvel with joy that one day when the King returns, it wasn't me. Whatever I did, investing the gospel, preaching, teaching, helping, ministering, the kind of expanded reward and glorious participation in the kingdom, does that just overwhelm you with amazement that that would be so? The King has gone to the distant country, and he's returning soon. And the question is, are you prepared to meet him with great joy? Let's bow together.